Welcome to Trailblazers, where we explore the inspiring journeys of entrepreneurs and industry leaders who are redefining success and making a lasting impact. These game changers are driving progress in our region and around the world. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Melody Bradford. Tonight on Trailblazers, we're talking about leadership, but differently. Not flashy leadership, not performative leadership, but leadership rooted in trust, relationships, consistency, and the long game. My guest tonight is Tony DeRay, CEO of BSI Corporate Benefits, one of the region's most respected employee benefits and consulting firms, known not only for the work that they do for clients, but for their culture, reputation, and community impact they've built along the way. Tony's story is one of entrepreneurship, resilience, vision, and values. From helping build BSI into an award-winning organization to becoming a deeply respected figure throughout the Lehigh Valley business and philanthropic communities, he has spent years proving that success and generosity do not have to exist separately. Alongside his wife, Tony has also helped fuel countless charitable efforts, nonprofit initiatives, and community causes, leading not for attention, but from a genuine belief in giving back and investing in people. Tonight, we're talking about business, leadership, philanthropy, legacy, adversity, personal growth, and what it truly means to build something that lasts. Please welcome a leader whose impact extends far beyond the boardroom, Tony DeRay. Thanks,
Tony,
so much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Tony, before the title, before the success and the recognition, who were you growing up, and what early experiences shaped your work ethic and worldview?
Certainly, my parents, I talk about them quite regularly. I'm very fortunate they're both still on the earth and, you know, celebrating 54 years of marriage something in that range. They were high school sweethearts at Allentown Central Catholic. But my dad was a basketball coach and a high school teacher. My mom was, you know, I say administrative or executive assistant. She doesn't acknowledge that term. She was a secretary for 45 years to four different CEOs of a healthcare company, Geisinger Health System. So, but they're really the foundation that I've certainly learned over time of almost everything. We call it in my house the DNA, DNA. So almost every decision I've had to make, business or otherwise, it's usually rooted in not necessarily, they weren't parents who said these are the rules and they were on our refrigerator. It was more do as I do in the house that I grew up in. So even though they aren't entrepreneurs, they weren't in the business world, it really has given me a lot of clarity as I've moved through my career and growing BSI, the kind of black and white decisions, you know, with respect to right and wrong and who I'm supposed to be in the community, who are we supposed to be as an organization. It all comes from them.
Yeah, and that leadership kind of philosophy or background, it's a perfect example of how you conduct yourself now. You founded BSI with a vision that clearly went beyond simply just selling benefits. What gap did you see in the industry, and what made you believe you could build something different and impactful?
Well, I think more than the nature of what we do as an employee benefits consulting firm, I think the entrepreneurial piece of it for me was really what like kind of led me in the direction. I worked for a healthcare company that was owned by the University of Michigan, so I was a University of Michigan employee. So working for the insurance company or carrier, I had an opportunity to work with a lot of individuals like me, or BSI is for the clients today. And I recognized pretty early on that I liked what they were doing a lot more than I liked what I was doing, you know, and I wanted to represent the client, not the insurance carrier. So the entrepreneurial piece, and then that was my job, kind of led me to, all right, I have a decision to make here. I was 23 years old. Do I go to work for another organization, kind of similar to a BSI, or do I hang up a shingle and give it a rip? You know, so I was 23 at the time. I was single. I didn't have any kids. Didn't have a mortgage, you know. So my determination is that what I certainly lacked in any knowledge base about running a business or anything, I made up for in if I fell on my butt, so what? I didn't have I didn't have a lot of responsibilities in my life. So that was kind of the nature of that decision making, you know, at the time to kind of go in that direction. But definitely could see in working with individuals in my space that there was a huge gap in what kind of value could be brought to a client in a professional services business.
Yeah, and let me just say, I mean, I've had the pleasure of working with you guys on the receiving end, on the collaboration, from the collaboration perspective. You've earned a reputation for not only expertise, but for relationships, trust, and client loyalty. What do you believe separates a transactional business like employee health benefits from one that becomes truly trusted? Because you guys really knock it out of the park. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, you know, I think the worst in our business, I call them spreadsheet warriors, you know, so yeah. Basically you're going to a bunch of insurance companies and you're adding 3-5% on the top of the letterhead and then mailing it on to the client, you know, just a complete commodity-based type of environment.
Yeah.
And because of my service background, you know, when I started to work for, I worked in high school for Geisinger, but I was always on the client service side with different jobs that I had in the industry. So everybody loves new business. You know, it's the sexy part of anybody's job, the new mm-hmm. business side. But in our business, it's a residual business, meaning we don't want just a client for a year. We want them for life.
Mm-hmm.
So in order to do that and be sticky with a client, there has to be more than just here's a spreadsheet with your health insurance rates.
Right.
You know? So I think that's really how we've evolved as being fully integrated partners with our clients. So it's not just the line item that mm-hmm. we're responsible for and have the expertise, which we do, but more looking at the organizations that we represent as true partners. And whether it's the specific thing that we're doing for them or just in general, when you talk about nonprofits specifically, adopting their mission as ours, fully integrated partners with clients is what I think has really led to the success of BSI over, you know, the last 20 years.
Yeah, and so you have your corporate clients, but a lot of people hear about corporate benefits and think paperwork and policies, but the reality is that your work impacts families and employees and individuals, to make healthcare decisions, sustain financial security, quality of life. How do you view the responsibility behind the work BSI does for clients?
Well, I say this to my team.
And when I say that, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
when
sure.
I say that, I mean the individual, because that's really at the core of where, a lot of the impact is made.
Sure. And I say this to my teammates at BSI all the time. We represent almost $1 billion in insurance mm-hmm. premium that gets paid by our clients on a yearly basis. The majority of our clients across the country are self-funded, which means we got a lot of analytics people walking around BSI that are looking at data on a monthly basis, claims. And what I always am telling not just our analytics team, but also our account teams, is that behind every line item medical claim, there is a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And the bigger that number is on that claim, that means it's usually a pretty significant moment in that person and that family's life. You know, if you show me a six-figure, $100,000 claim, I'm going to show you a family that's probably going through a very significant life event,
mm-hmm.
right? And bills could be piling up, and certainly, you know, depending on the illness or whatever is happening, that's a really big thing. And mm-hmm. to keep in mind that these are human beings on the other side of what we do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just for the companies that we represent. It's also, we are partners with their employees, of course. But from as anybody knows, you get your health insurance through the company you work for. In a lot of cases, it's not just the person who actually works for the company. It's their significant other, their husband, their wife, their kids. So understanding that we have a responsibility to show up for all of those human beings
mm-hmm.
and be their advocates in a system that is very difficult to navigate, you know. So if people don't recognize how difficult our health system is to navigate,
mm-hmm.
I usually say congratulations, because you haven't used it. And that's a benefit, because anybody that's had to go through anything from a medical or pharmacy situation understands that it gets really complicated really quick,
yeah.
right? And you need advocates. You need advocates more than just the 800 number on the back of your insurance card, because that's a recipe for a long day.
Yeah, and, you know, let's pause there for a second, because, you know, some of my next questions are going to go into your leadership style. But health insurance, health benefits affect everybody. Where do you see the industry going? Like, I just got a renewal notice for my property and casualty that we're probably going to be going up 16%. And I'm like, oh my goodness, you know. But from the medical or the health benefit perspective, you made a good point that this affects the individual on the financial level. How do you guys, from an advocacy standpoint, how do you guys mitigate the risk or, you know, help them along, one? And then two, where do you see the industry going? Do you see premiums just continuing to rise? Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah, it really is. I think anybody that is out there running around saying we could reduce healthcare spending by 30% is probably selling fool's gold. That's not the conversations that we typically have with clients or even individuals. It's about managing that cost curve over a period of time, because mm-hmm. if you can slow the rate that the cost of healthcare rises, that's where companies in that gap can really win, you know, in that line item and still keep benefits at a high level. Because that's, unfortunately, you know, some companies that aren't BSI typically represented, they have a higher increase, and the only thing that they turn around and do is they push it down to their employees, mm-hmm. right? And that's not good for anybody, mm-hmm. right? It's not good for the culture of an organization. It's certainly not good for the pocketbook of, you know, the employees that work there. So, but there are so many pressures on our healthcare system right now. So if you talk about GLPs, weight loss medication, mm-hmm. Specialty medication, there are medications right now that can cost $1, $2 million for one dose.
Wow.
Right? And when those things hit the bottom line of companies, you know, there better be protection, you know, from risk there. But you have, you know, pharmaceuticals who do amazing things, right? Save lives. The same thing with GLPs. Certainly, the jury's probably still out as far as the data, and we're getting a lot of data in about, you know, people who are, you know, go on, they lose a little bit of weight, they go off, gain the weight back. You know, so there's a lot of data that's now coming in on, like, weight loss medications. But they work, right? There's no question that they accomplish the goal, you know, of weight loss and some other things, but they're expensive. Who's going to pay for them, mm-hmm. right? So that's a big component. And then in general, just the U.S. healthcare system, you've just got, you have an overall population in the United States that's not healthy. So 40% of the U.S. population is defined as obese, right? So those are going to be continued challenges, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea of healthcare costs what it costs, in part because the average American is not the healthiest human being walking around, you know, on the street. So I think that, you know, we want to try to manage risk for organizations for when catastrophic claims happen that can't be predicted. But then on the human level, we really want to have that relationship with the end user, the employee or the family, to be able to give them and provide them tools and resources mm-hmm. to take control of their health proactively.
Right?
Because that is the best prescription across the board, which is if you're doing the right things from a health perspective, great for the human being, also good for the pocketbook mm-hmm. of both the employee, but also the company that they work for.
Right. And what advice would you offer, potential corporation clients, or what conversation do you have with corporate partners or corporate clients that about, you know, how to plan now for future healthcare rising costs, as well as how to keep their employees healthy? What do you do from that perspective?
Well, it's a great question, because I think that our approach is much different than what we see in the market, where every employer who's listening understands. I call it the hamster on a wheel. So every year, healthcare renews, and you know, CFOs, CEOs, heads of HR, they're all waiting for, and I call it no whammies, you know. So you're going to get that healthcare increase, like you said, to 16%.
Right.
Is it going to be 25? Is it going to be 40? Or is it going to be 2?
Right.
And then kind of reacting to that every year, you know, there's this meeting, and then, you know, it comes blind. So what we really preach with organizations, and it's such a misnomer when you hear, well, our claims are our claims. What are we supposed to do about that? There is a ton of things that can be done to control cost.
Interesting.
One of the first things is companies have 3, 5, 10-year plans for everything else that they do. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're whatever, if they're selling, if they're manufacturing, whatever it is, they have long-term plans, right? For top line, for bottom line, for how they manage their entire companies. We try to preach, have a long-term plan for your employee benefits program.
Super smart.
So the idea of saying, or what do we want to accomplish over a 5-year period? I mean, companies have 5-year plans for everything.
Right.
Have a plan for your employee benefits program. So it's not just hamster on a wheel, reactively dealing with an increase and then cutting benefits or charging your employees more. What is our plan over 5 years? What are we looking to accomplish? And one of those things is we want to hold down medical trend. So if you show a graph that instead of getting 12% on average for 5 years, you cut that in half and get 5 or 6, that delta, that difference doesn't sound like a lot, but, you know, compound is compound. And over a 5-year period, mm-hmm. for a lot of organizations, that can be millions of dollars in cost. And then it's a matter of having a plan and executing it. And the reason that you need a runway of that long period of time, first of all, you need protection for risk as an organization as you go. But ultimately, you have to reach the end user of healthcare, which is the employee or their family. Mm-hmm. So you can have all the greatest plans in the ivory tower, you know, where you're in a boardroom where you're making decisions on your what you're going to offer your
right.
employees. But if those tools and resources don't get to the front porch of the end user,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to work.
Right.
You know, and that's where so many organizations, you know, companies fall down. They have all these plans. They may have these wellness tools. They may have all these things. And then we look at utilization and nobody is using them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think you need time because everybody's been through an open enrollment. It usually lasts about 15 minutes. Sometimes it's in a break room. Sometimes it's in the basement. Sometimes you just get an email,
yeah.
right? That's not enough time to be able to educate an employee or their family on the resources that's available to them that they're paying for. There's money coming out of the employees' paychecks for healthcare in almost every company in America at this point. Educating them on what's available, you can't do that in 15 minutes
right.
for 1 year, right?
Yeah.
So you have to, over a longer period of time, really work with employees to and their significant others, because that's a, I think that's a really big piece that companies miss as well. You know, and I hate to pick on men, but this is the reality, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, Carl in a break room gets the open enrollment packet, doesn't listen for 30 minutes, then mm-hmm. goes home and throws it on the counter and says, you know, to his wife,
fill it out.
Hey, fill it out, make some decisions, and I'll take it back. Like,
yeah.
that's the way it happens. So what we want to try to do is we want to talk to Carl's wife.
Yeah.
Right? We want to give Carl's wife the opportunity to sit on webinars or sign up, you know, herself, because if she's the one that's taking care of healthcare in their family, even though it's coming through Carl's company, we need her to be educated
right.
on things like telemedicine and when the kids get sick and, you know, what are some of the resources or tools that we have available. So it's really about education over a longer sustained period of time.
Yeah. And so that service model has built a very successful company for you. As you have grown, how has your leadership style evolved over time? Talk to me a little bit about that, because you've seen a lot. You've grown the team. You now have a chief people officer, right?
That's correct.
Val Lewis. She's wonderful.
She
you
is.
Have a great team over there. But
talk
to me a little bit about how your leadership has evolved as your company has grown.
So I feel like every time I, you know, coming on 23 years since I filed the LLC paperwork for BSI.
Okay.
But about every 5 years I look back, I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm horrified at the leader I was the 5 years before. That's probably not the track that people should take. But I think it's battle scars. You know, it's learning from mistakes.
Growing pains.
I mean, you know, mm-hmm. I think you want to be able to, especially when you're starting a business from scratch. Only probably in the last 5 or 6 years, I'd say right around the COVID turn, did my role as a CEO kind of switch towards working on the business as opposed to working in it.
Mm-hmm.
So for the better part of, you know, 15 to 20 years, my head was down in the company doing the work, you know, trying to grow, trying to survive mm-hmm. as an organization, so that the opportunity that I've had for the last, you know, 5 or 6 years to really work on the business, which includes working on all of my faults, you know, which are the list is long as a leader, but it's learning from mistakes, you know. And I think that I'm from an athletic household. My dad was a basketball player. He was my basketball coach. I played college football. My brother played college football with me at Wilkes University. I played competitive rugby for 10 years after college, all around the country. So the coaches, the people that I was closest to, tend to communicate love from about an inch from my face. So I would say that—
Hopefully you don't do that in the office.
Well, I think I kind of used to be that kind of leader because that's— it motivated me, you know. There are a lot of things that sports can carry over into the boardroom or a company. There are some that don't translate so well, you know. And I think that that, from a leadership perspective, having empathy and understanding the human beings that you're working with, my teammates every day, that's definitely been lessons that I've learned over time, you know, as far as my approach to the whole human being as a teammate of mine, and not just, you know, this is a job, you're compensated well, we have a job to do, they're our clients, right? So it's been a shift that way.
Yeah, well, and I mean, you have very little turnover, so you must be doing something right. And you've built a team that's widely respected throughout the region. You have some really great people over there. What qualities do you look for in the people you surround yourself with professionally? And not just from, you know, internal, you know, within your office, but you work a lot with those in the community and form collaborations and do a lot of things. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Well, I used to think, you know, you could teach somebody from a culture perspective. You know, there's that saying, you know, just you know, don't be a not nice person. is a saying. I think the shift for us as an organization, you mentioned Val Lewis, who's our chief people officer, who's had 12 jobs in her 14 years with me, side by side, by the way. She's amazing and really the architect of who we are as a company. But our big shift that happened 5 or 6 years ago, right before COVID, because it was out of necessity. You know, at that time, we were hard charging, looked great on paper, getting all the awards. We were burning people out, right? Mm. We were just burning people out. And as a leadership team, we were burned out. So we had to kind of reassess, you know, is this what we want? Is this what success looks like for us? And it wasn't. And where we started that shift there is putting our people first, right? And focusing on the culture and hiring for culture. We can teach people deductibles and coinsurance and all of the, you know, the words in our industry. We can teach that. Culture's harder to teach. So we solely recruit for culture at this point. So where we used to be nervous, you know, when we had a couple of new employees start because, hey, we don't want to screw up a good thing. You know, we got such a good thing here. And as everybody knows, one toxic human being absolutely can spoil. So we used to be nervous about it. But the way in which, you know, Val has built our people and culture department, we have a wonderful young professional woman, Jess Beglumini, who's just been fantastic in the role managing that department. But by the time that individuals who all, you know, to a person say that our process can be exhausting, I always say that I don't know if I could get a job at BSI the way it exists today, because there's a lot of vetting along the way. But what our current BSI teammates understand now, so we have the biggest hiring phase that we've ever been on at BSI, probably 25% growth. We've hired about 14 or 15 people, which will take us to almost 70, 75 people.
Wow.
A lot. But what our team knows is meeting these new human beings, because of our process, they know that they're about to meet a good human being, right? Just a good human being. I mean, the work is the work, and that's to be seen whether people can, you know, obviously deliver. But these are really good human beings because we're hiring for that. We're hiring for culture first. So when they come in as BSI teammates and then they're seeing what we do, not just for clients, but what we do, what our obligation is, I feel, to our community and certainly to the most in need, we have the expectation and they're the kinds of human beings that understand that and want to be part of a community and want to be able to give back. It's not just about compensation, you know, and getting ahead in individual accomplishment. So I think that's that shift to really putting our people before anything, before clients, before new business, focusing on our BSI employees and their families has really been a game changer for us.
Yeah, and I'm going to shift gears possibly here for a second, because perhaps one of them deals with culture, but BSI has actually received numerous recognitions and industry awards over the years. What accomplishments are you most proud of and why? Have you gotten anything that speaks to culture or any of that?
Absolutely. I think, you know, I can remember a time, boy, I would love to just, you know, after getting local recognition or regional recognition, man, national recognition. And, you know, and we've been on the Inc. fastest growing companies in the country, I think 6 out of the last 7 years. Mm-hmm. All of those are great from a business perspective. You know, the company is doing extremely well. The ones that I'm most proud of, because they weren't the awards that we would always get, are the people awards. So, you know, we're I think it'll probably be it'll be announced here pretty soon, but we're getting named the best places to work in the United States for the 5th year in a row, which if you went back 10 years, we wouldn't have been on that list, you know. So the idea that my BSI teammates, who, you know, obviously complete surveys and do those kind of things, feel valued and feel like the organization has their best interests at heart, and more in a world where that just is not the case, right, from a company perspective, it means the world to me that that's what they think about their experience at BSI and about the organization, about me as a leader, truly caring about their well-being, their careers, giving them opportunities. You know, so any of the awards that we receive that has to do with the culture of the company that we built are the most impactful to me. And of course, obviously, you know, the recognition in the nonprofit, you know, community, that not just me personally, but anytime that BSI is getting recognized for showing up, you know, that's really my people that I work with every day. Because I can preach all I want about, hey, we want to show up in the community and we want to do this and write the check. But I think what really has set us apart in our communities is that our people show up. They show up a lot, right, with their treasure and their time, and they're out there in the world, you know, and they're making their mark, you know?
And speaking about showing up, you're known not just as a business leader, but as someone deeply engaged in the Lehigh Valley community. You and your wife, you know, you've spent a lot of time with community involvement, philanthropy. Why has community involvement remained such an important part of your life and leadership philosophy? And to that point, what advice would you offer other leaders from that perspective?
Well, I'd go back to where we started with my parents. You know, my parents, that proverbial shirt off your back type of human beings, right? It wasn't a rule. They didn't go over it with me. Me and my brother were able to just grow up in a house where we had two human beings that would just continue to show up for their community, for their friends and family, always the first to be there at a moment's notice. So that was ingrained in me. And, you know, no, they weren't entrepreneurs and didn't own a for-profit business. But the principles that are behind that are really what I was always been grounded on. So, you know, that idea of this is an obligation. I think it's such a misnomer and people get so carried away. And I guess this is always just pulls through me. Just because I own a for-profit business, why does that have to be the only thing, right? If my dad was a school teacher and a coach, you know, he was a union teacher. His salary for his entire 40 years was dictated by union contracts, and it usually went up about 2% a year. So you don't measure a teacher necessarily by their bank account. Right. So
it's how you show up.
So I was always get confused by that, where organizations just think to themselves, well, we're a for-profit company and making money is the only important thing. I wasn't raised that way, you know. So I've tried to take those principles that, you know, my parents showed me through their actions. And I think whereas it might be a difficult a decision for maybe some other organizations or individuals, companies, those things have always been really clear to me. It is a responsibility, you know, that we always give more than we take from the communities that we serve.
And you're a perfect example of that. 30 seconds. At this stage in your life and career, how do you personally define success now compared to your earlier journey?
Just talking about this the other day, what I really love more than anything, I've probably had 20 roles in 23 years at BSI, but seeing my BSI teammates accomplish even some things that they didn't think that professionally or personally they could accomplish, you know, so you have a young woman who starts on our front desk and now, you know, has risen 6-7 positions in the firm, is leading other people. We have examples of that all across BSI. You know, to see these individuals, you know, I guess it's a sign of, you know, almost being 50 years old. Everybody under 30 is a kid for me. Like, we have kids who are married and have other kids. They're still kids to me, you know, but the idea of really celebrating them on a daily basis and watching what they're accomplishing, really. And BSI success is really all about our next gen of leaders. And we have a tremendous next gen.
Elevating others. In a world that often celebrates speed, noise, and visibility, Tony's leadership reflects something different: consistency, humility, discipline, generosity, and long-term impact. Through BSI, through his leadership, and through the philanthropic work he and his wife continue to support throughout the region, Tony has helped shape the Lehigh Valley in ways that extend far beyond business. And tonight's conversation was a reminder that some of the strongest leaders are the ones that quietly but intentionally create lasting impact over time. Thank you for joining us on another episode of Trailblazers. I'm Melody Bradford, and we'll see you next time as we continue spotlighting the leaders, builders, and visionaries shaping our communities and beyond.